Workman presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, June 15th. We have two matters on our calendar for oral argument, in addition to several cases before us for non-oral consideration. The first case today is the matter of Dr. Eric Steffen versus Scott Utley et al. Counsel, I know you're both familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you that it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent for our audio recording. You will notice that there are two options available for you today. You could present your argument from the podium near your counsel table. The only downside to that is it doesn't have the lights. Or you could use the center podium, which does have the lighting. And we will make you aware of your time if that becomes an issue. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Thomas Boyd. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Eric Steffen, and with me today are my partners, Joe Windler and Christina Lucas. Dr. Steffen respectfully requests the court to reverse the judgment and to remand to the district court for further proceedings on a number of issues. First of all, for further proceedings and an entry of judgment in the amount of the unpaid dividends that Dr. Steffen is owed and should have been paid to him through the time he closed on the purchase or the sale of his stock. Secondly, for further proceedings and a trial on whether Dr. Steffen is entitled to fair value for his shares as the appropriate remedy due to the evidence of abuse, prejudice, oppression, and frustration of expectations as a shareholder. Third, for further proceedings and correction of a judgment that was entered against Dr. Steffen for advanced overdraws that he received that it should have been reduced because of his partner's actions that affected his earnings as well as an offset for deferred compensation. And finally, for a reassessment as to whether Dr. Steffen should be deemed as the prevailing party. Turning first to the issue of Dr. Steffen's right to receive unpaid dividends. The district court erred in holding that his rights to receive dividends from his stock terminated at the time his employment terminated on August 5, 2018. However, he continued to own those shares. He continued to be a shareholder. And because he was a shareholder, he was entitled to all the rights as a shareholder, including the dividends. Dr. Steffen is entitled to an award of unpaid dividends owed through the time of closing.
Does that flow from your argument that the corporate entities were in default at that time?
That's an alternative argument. Our central argument is there's nothing in the redemption agreements that would alter his rights as a shareholder. He continued to own those shares to the extent the stock sale and redemption agreements address dividends and voting rights. They focused on the purchaser and when the purchaser may have or not have those rights. But there's nothing in the agreement that indicates that Dr. Steffen is the shareholder, that his rights were terminated at the time of his employment, or when he offered to sell the stock, or when that offer was purportedly accepted.
So, counsel, you're limiting that claim, though, to ESA and SPO, those agreements, right? Not as to SPEC?
No, it applies as to his shares in all three entities.
All three. And help me out on that with the language that I'm looking at from the SPEC agreement says that there would be no dividends issued by the eye clinic on the shares being purchased.
While they're being purchased.
So that's your, okay. So
while they're being purchased. The process in which they're purchased begins at the time of closing and runs through the time the purchaser satisfies its obligations under the note. And that's quite clear.
Okay, so help me out. You're saying that the judge's analysis, you know, emphasizing the date of termination is wrong.
Correct.
And it should be purchase. And that's based on your understanding of your interpretation of those contracts.
That's
right?
Correct. It's clear under Minnesota law, the Derwitz case, the Minnesota Supreme Court made it very clear that neither the common law nor the corporate statute terminated a shareholder's rights at the time their employment was terminated. There has to be something specific in the redemption agreements that terminate those rights, and there is none.
So I think if I understand the district court's reasoning, that the court is reading these contracts to be certainly about purchase and to reflect some rights for the purchaser, but that it doesn't necessarily dictate that someone who's for whom the shareholder status has been terminated, that they would continue to receive dividends. So, you know, the silence that you see is not the silence that the district court judges
see. Right, and it's a de novo review, so the important thing is what this court sees. The court erred. The focus of 1.3, I believe it's provisions I and J that deal with dividends and voting rights, focus on when those rights pass to the purchaser. And as a matter of logic and law, they can't pass until the purchaser actually acquires the stock. Prior to that, the stock is owned by and all the rights are vested in the selling shareholder. And it's analogous to when you sell your home. You enter into a purchase agreement, I agree to accept your offer. But you don't own the house at that time. You don't have any rights in the house. You don't take possession and ownership until you actually close and title passes.
But it wasn't part of the problem that there was no closing because your client refused to, in fact, close?
That's a disputed issue, and the judge determined that the appropriate closing date should be July 15, 2019. So we're entitled to dividends at least through that period of time, but we believe the court erred because he did not find that the purchaser was actually prepared to close. We also argued that the purchaser was in default. And so the appropriate the appropriate closing was the actual closing date, which is December 10, 2020, or 21, excuse me, 2010-21.
I want to back you up just a moment before you go on to another issue. But with respect to the argument about the right to continuing dividends,
yes.
As Judge Bradfeld pointed out, differing language in the redemption agreements between the iClinic and SPO and ESA because of that purchaser language.
Right.
A respondent makes many arguments about waived arguments, you know, because things weren't raised in the district court and preserved. Does that factor into this at all? It seemed to me that that appellant in the district court acknowledged the difference in that language between the agreements.
We acknowledged it in terms of making the alternative argument.
Okay.
But respondent themselves in their brief point out that we've always made the argument that acceptance of an offer does not deprive the seller of the voting and dividend rights. And that's at page 21 of their brief, citing to our a memorandum of law we filed in the district court, document 51, at pages 20 and 22. So we've always made that argument as to all three. The reason why there's different languages in the two, and SPO and ESA, I believe, there's the option of you offer it to the company first, but a third party could buy it. At the time of closing, if the third party buys it, they immediately get the rights to voting and receiving dividends, or at least receiving dividends. Whereas if it's sold to the company, it's put in treasury stock. In both cases, that stock is pledged back to the shareholder. So the important thing for the court to look at is when title passes, when the homeowner sells the property and closes on it. It's that point that is critical. Here, if you didn't recognize that, if you had some hybrid where between an offer and closing, the owner of the shares had voting rights but not dividend rights, then you have issued stock that's being treated differently. Everybody else's stock has all of those rights, but this seller is deprived of the right to dividends, which is also adverse and contrary to corporate law.
Thank you.
With regard to the fair value issue, the district court further erred in refusing to permit Dr. Steffen to present evidence on whether fair value would be the appropriate remedy. The district court had specifically found that the defendants acted in a manner unfairly prejudicial to Dr. Steffen by frustrating his reasonable expectations of having a voice in the management of the SPEC entities.
So a buyout remedy was appropriate for that conduct, correct?
We disagree that it's appropriate. We do recognize that it could be appropriate.
And that's your argument
that we were asking for a buyout, and we were asking for a buyout at fair value.
Well, I think initially your client is asking for dissolution of the corporate entities, as among other relief. But the buyout, if I'm understanding your argument, is if buyout is an appropriate remedy, the dollar amount was, the calculation of that was improper, that the district court erred by looking to the language of the various agreements under the circumstances.
And erred by doing so, and also erred by not also considering evidence of an alternative remedy, which we thought was appropriate, and we believe the law requires that the court consider, having found the oppressive and prejudicial behavior, or prejudicial actions, and the frustration of purpose. We believe that's something the district court was required to do, first of all, because he said he would do it in the bifurcation order and failed to do so. Secondly,
on what basis do you conclude that the district court didn't consider the alternative? I mean, it certainly wasn't granted, but
you're right, the
bifurcation order suggests the district court's going to consider it.
He considered the abstract concept, but he did not receive evidence. And that was what was excluded when he ordered the case bifurcated a year and a half before it went to trial. And that's what Dr. Steffen was deprived of offering. He had evidence, including expert opinions, that he was prepared to offer, and the court declined to consider that. That's wrong based on his order. He didn't fulfill what he said he would do. Second, that's wrong on the law. Under the statute, once you find that there has been oppression, prejudice, frustration of expectations, then the court must consider equitable remedies. Doesn't have to grant them, but has to consider them, and you can't consider them only in the abstract. The moving or the party seeking the relief has the right to offer evidence and be heard in a meaningful way, in an evidentiary way.
Is this another issue, Mr. Boyd, where you could argue that it was not preserved because no post-trial motion was brought?
No, that's completely, the respondent's position is completely incorrect. The Supreme Court's decision in Hennepin County versus Botka rejects that. It states that a post-trial motion is required for rulings during trial. But here, the pretrial ruling, followed briefing and argument and was made, I think, in March of 2020, and the case went to trial in May of 2021. So under all of the elements identified by the Supreme Court, there is no need or requirement for a post-trial motion to preserve this issue.
I thought Botka dealt specifically with in limine motions that are typically brought on the eve of trial. As you said, this was the bifurcation order was something that was in advance.
You're right. And on the eve of trial, even the Supreme Court held, maybe it was shortly before trial, but not on the eve. It was, I think, 3 weeks or several weeks ahead, sufficiently apart from or prior to the trial itself to give the court adequate time to consider the matter. And what I'm arguing, I recognize that was a motion to limine case, but all of the elements that the court identified to rule that the motion in limine was a pretrial order that didn't require a post-trial motion apply here. Briefing, argument, plenty of time to consider not only a ruling 3 weeks before trial, here it was a year and some months before trial. In addition to the reasons I've already stated, the case should be remanded for a trial on fair value because of another finding made by the court, which was error. And that was the finding that Dr. Steffen, or that distributions that were owed to Dr. Steffen as a shareholder were delayed by more than a year. And the court found that was treatment that was different from the way the other shareholders were treated. He did hold that was not a breach of fiduciary duty, and therefore did not reach the issue of whether that's a frustration of reasonable expectations. That was error because clearly that's a frustration of reasonable expectations. And the problem with the court's decision is he didn't address that issue. And that was inconsistent with the Lund case. And there's a difference of opinion between respondent and appellant as to how to read that case. But we've discussed it at length in our reply brief. And if the court looks at the district court's opinion, it's quite clear that the court held even where there's no breach of fiduciary duty, if there's mistreatment or unfair treatment or disparate treatment or frustration of expectations, then the equitable remedy is available. So you can have actions that don't breach a fiduciary duty, but still frustrate expectations and give rise to the relief sought. I see I have 12 seconds left. I've briefed other issues. If the court has any questions about those issues, I can answer them. Otherwise, I'll step down. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Where's the button? Oh, here it is. Got it.
May it please the court, Todd Wind, along with my partner, Pari Magara, on behalf of the respondents. I'm going to obviously be more than happy to address any questions the panel has along the way. I'm going to take these issues in slightly different order than Mr. Boyd. I want to step back and give the court a little context for this case because I think it plays directly into the key analysis of the circumstances that the court was to consider in granting the remedy that it granted. When the appellant started this case, he complained of fiduciary duties against three different sets of defendants. And those fiduciary duties centered around his complaints about his Mercedes and his complaints about the credit card program and complaints about committee operations, all kinds of things, a whole raft of complaints. Those are all described in Judge Ilka's summary judgment order, and you can see that none of those survived. None. None of the fiduciary duty claims were successful, and none of them were appealed. So on all of those counts, when you get to the argument that Mr. Boyd never got to, which is they think they were the prevailing party, that's one piece of context for you. The four issues that the court did find were trial worthy were: one, did he have a reasonable expectation of cash value versus accrual value because of the mistake in the way that the parties had handled the buyouts? He lost that issue at trial. Two, the withholding of dividends. Was that unfair under the circumstances? He lost that issue at trial. Three, did he get notice of meetings that in a way that prejudiced him? He lost that issue at trial and hasn't appealed it. And four, when did his governance rights end? And the court sided with us that it was July 16, 2019. But found that he was removed from the board of directors by a procedurally improper mechanism. He didn't sign the written action. So the court said, well, technically, that's not fair because it's not a valid action. But he found, importantly for your analysis, on page 12 of his order, Judge Ilka found no damages. He had failed to prove any damages for his governance issues. He didn't appeal that either.
He failed to sign it, but I mean, he was never presented with it, was he? I mean, it seemed like this was correct. Something that was done without his involvement.
Correct.
Entirely. Okay.
So there was a procedural defect in the way he was removed from the board. But importantly, though, the court did not take issue with the motives. I mean, he was at that point seeking to dissolve the companies, and so they decided to remove him. They may have done it incorrectly, and the judge found that that was unfair. But he found no damages, and that wasn't appealed. And the reason that's important is if you look at, so for instance, the Gunderson case, and there's others that will say the prejudice or the oppression has to have a tie in order to undo the formula that's in the agreement. And that brings me to the remedy that he chose. because if you look at the statute, and I left my statute, so I'll be right back. If you look at the language of the statute, it is mandatory that the court enforce the buy-sell provisions if there are buy-sell provisions. And interestingly, they rely a lot on the Lund case over and over again, but the Lund case didn't have a buy-sell, right? And in fact, they can point to no law, really, where the court has ignored the buy-sell provisions.
But the statute, I agree with you, does reference any documents that might govern the question, but also gives the district court discretion to, in addition, make other awards or provide other relief that the circumstances deem necessary. I see that there's oppression here and no real remedy other than what the documents provide.
So the cases say, and Gunderson is a good example of that, that it is a mandatory standard you apply the agreements unless the circumstances say it's unreasonable to do so. And that's why I talked about the circumstances. Because the oppression that you mentioned was simply the removal in a little bit early from the board in a procedurally improper way with no damage. And so, and we'll get to these to the other elements, but having that set of circumstances, then the court said there's no connection between the buy-sell provision and the remedy. Now, the other issue they take, and this may further illuminate the discussion, the other issue they take with the remedy is that the court's findings of accrual versus cash. And the important thing that I'd like to point the court to is in 3A of the statute, it says the court shall consider the reasonable expectations of all shareholders, not of Dr. Stefan, of all shareholders as they exist at the inception and develop during the course of the shareholders' relationship with the corporation and with each other. And the reason I point that out to you is the district court did a very thorough job of analyzing the relationship as it developed over time. So you start with the presumption that the written agreements reflect the expectations of the parties. That's a given. Then you say, what happens from there? And he took you through a step-by-step of what happened with each buyout, what Dr. Stefan's expectations at each time were. And he never had an expectation that he would be bought out on a cash basis. It was always insistent that the documents should control. But here's where it gets really interesting. And I think it's paragraph 40. It's paragraph 40 or 47 of his order, of his findings. What he found was, this issue came to light for the group as a whole when Dr. Kennedy was bought out, and they had to figure out what to do. And they decided, well, we have some options. We could change our methodology and go to a cash-based system, or we could do this other thing, or we could leave them as it is, leave the agreements as they are. They made a group decision to leave the agreements as they were, and Dr. Stefan was treated exactly like everybody else. So if you think about the expectations...
Well, or everybody else, I think your argument is from that time forward, because in fact the record shows that people were treated differently than what the documents
That's
require.
Correct. And importantly, though, that language of the statute says as they develop over time, and what are the expectations of the shareholders? And if you marry that up with Gunderson, which... and Weigert, we cite these cases in our brief... The Weigert case and Gunderson both say that if the decision is made in the legitimate exercise of the authority under the corporation's business, legitimate business objectives, if that's what motivates the decision as opposed to something prejudicial, then it's not unfair conduct. And that is absolutely critical for this case because he decided... with detailed factual findings, which are reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard or clearly erroneous standard, that the expectations that Dr. Stefan had at the beginning and as they developed over time, including when they made this change, he wasn't treated unfairly. And that brings me to the dividend discussion that you were having with Mr. Boyd, because the court also found that the decision to withhold dividends was reasonable. Now, Mr. Boyd, I think, misspoke. He said that the court did not reach the decision, reach the analysis on whether it constituted unfairly prejudicial conduct. That's not true. In paragraph 31 of his conclusions of law, he specifically found that the same reasons it didn't constitute a fiduciary duty breach, it wasn't unfairly prejudicial. He recognized in paragraph 10 of the conclusions of law that what the standard was. So he did recognize the standard, and he simply applied the same facts. And again, if you look at Weigert and Gunderson, they both say if the decision is motivated by legitimate objectives of the entity and not some prejudicial motive, then it is not unfair. That finding also is an abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous standard, and it's clearly right. So the withholding piece is pretty clear. So that brings me to the continuing dividends analysis. Dr. Steffen's argument that he is entitled to dividends until closing is first contrary to the language of the agreement, as the court found, that is so long as during the purchase process, which is triggered by the deemed offer to sell. Because as Judge Bradwell pointed out, at least in the spec agreement, there's nothing to do after the offer is made. So then during that process, the purchaser gets the dividends or the seller doesn't. And interestingly, there is no law cited by the appellant for the proposition that if the company gets the dividends or is the purchaser, that the seller retains those rights. They don't cite any law for that proposition. And it's contrary to the statutes. Minnesota Statute 323A553 says that when a company reacquires its shares, it doesn't get the dividends. That's all the ESA and SPO agreements do. So it just treats it as treasury stock, and Judge Ilka's decision in that regard was correct. Now the default argument that the appellant raises, he says, first of all, SPEC was in default. The court found that we did absolutely everything we could to make an unconditional tender, an unconditional closing. All we said was you have to return your stock certificates to us, and that's required by the agreement. We made it very clear we were ready, willing, and able to close and give him a note. And the judge found that, and the judge found it was unreasonable for him not to close. So that, again, that factual finding is a clearly erroneous standard and is defensible. With regard to the SPO and ESA arguments, those were waived. They were never raised below in terms of those two entities not closing within 90 days. So issues not raised there shouldn't be litigated here. Finally, regarding the counterclaims, he makes two arguments on our counterclaims. One, he says that the $33,000 deferred compensation should have been offset against the $40,000 judgment. And frankly, we agree that we put in evidence in summary judgment that laid out the math, and those weren't disputed. This is a Rule 60.01 issue that should have been brought by the appellant and wasn't. Now, if they still want to have it corrected, they could. And when Mr. Boyd gets back up here, you can ask him, but that issue is moot. That issue has already been netted out. They've simply paid the difference. That $33,000 is irrelevant. And so to burden the judicial process with an assignment of error on something they could have corrected and that is no longer an issue is not a good use of judicial resources. With regard, the last issue they complain about is that the court failed to consider his arguments on what they call patient mix, because when he came back from leave, he was seeing different types of patients. The reason the district court didn't consider that is that's not a legal defense. This was simply a math counterclaim, right? We said, you are overdrawn, and here's the math, and this is how much you owe. And his defense was, well, it shouldn't have been that way. Well, that's not a claim. Had he made a claim of some sort, then it might have offset the math, but there wasn't a claim. To the extent we tried to drill down on the legal basis for that argument, he said, all he said was, well, that's part of my employment claim. He has brought a number of lawsuits against these entities, and that's one of my other lawsuits. And so the judge thought, well, there's no legal claim in front of me, and so he didn't have to deal with it. And that's really the answer on the counterclaim. So
you're saying that's untethered to any legal theory?
Correct. Correct. So in sum, Your Honors, I started with the prevailing party issue because and that's why I gave you the context. I mean, this case, that's a pragmatic view as to whether somebody's the prevailing party. This case started with a huge net, and it wound up with one issue and no damage. He got the very relief that we offered from day one. The case shouldn't have been brought in the beginning, and he got exactly what he should have got from day one. So the prevailing party is pretty clear. We would ask that the district court's decisions on all counts be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Boyd, you have the last word.
Thank you. I'll try and be very focused. First, the argument of waiver regarding rulings on fiduciary duty claims and so forth, we appealed the judgment and all matters subsumed in the judgment, so there has been no waiver. Secondly, with regard to whether the court was mandated to apply the shareholder agreement formula and nothing else, that's simply an improper reading of the statute. The statute says where there are findings of oppression and frustration of purpose and so forth, while the court will consult the agreement, and perhaps the statute says it's presumed, it is not mandated. The statute is clear. The case law is clear. Where there's inequitable conduct, the court can and should look at equitable remedies. Third, with regard to remand for trial on fair value, the court should order remand not only based on the court's own finding that it was that he was treated oppressively and prejudicially and so forth in terms of his governance rights, but also because unquestionably, it's as a matter of, I would say, law, the fact that his distributions were delayed by a year is clearly a disparate treatment, unequal treatment compared to the others.
Well, the others hadn't sued seeking dissolution of the company. I mean, aren't all those facts sort of the broader context relevant? Yes, you said it was delayed, but this was in the course of, you know, hotly disputed litigation where your client was seeking.
Well, yes, but it was in the context of being a shareholder. He's entitled to be treated equally to the other shareholders, and the other shareholders received timely distributions. He had to wait a year. He also has had
and
to
that,
wait.
Again, I mean, counsel was involved at making, you know, isn't a company entitled to rely
on? That may get them off the hook for breach of fiduciary duty, but not, under Lund, that does not mean they're off the hook for inequitable treatment and frustration of expectation. And also, a third reason, we've argued that he's entitled to dividends through closing, and he's been deprived those. So he's been mistreated and unequally treated and prejudicially treated as a shareholder entitled to dividends, and he has not received those while the others have. For all those reasons, it should go back for a trial on fair value. With regard to counsel's argument about the company acquiring rights or not acquiring rights for dividends and voting and so forth, that's just not a relevant discussion or concept unless and until the company acquires the stock. They don't have pre-purchase rights or lack of rights to dividends. They don't have any rights to vote or to dividends until title passes. And that's the bright line marker here. And there's nothing in the shareholder agreement that in the meantime deprives Dr. Stephan of his rights as the owner, while he's the owner of the shares, to dividends. With regard to the judgment amount, the $40,000 for overdraws, First, I would ask counsel, where's the satisfaction of judgment? There's still a judgment for $40,000 out there. Second, with regard to whether that's the right amount, the district judge ruled on summary judgment that that was the right amount without considering our defense that it's the wrong amount, that they improperly reduced his earnings so his draft was in excess of those earnings. That's a defense. That's properly in front of the court. Doesn't have to be a legal theory for an affirmative award of damages. It's a defense that should reduce the amount of that judgment to zero. So that issue should also be remanded. And once these issues are remanded, we believe the court should reassess who's the prevailing party. And we believe the court will determine Dr. Steffen is the prevailing party. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case was well presented. We appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.